You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of March 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme...
The United States still considers the Russian actions to be illegal and illegitimate, and Russians' actions over the past several weeks have placed it at odds, obviously, with the rule of law and the international community, and we still believe on the wrong side of history.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov have been meeting in Paris, but a diplomatic solution to the crisis in Ukraine is still a long way off. Xenia Dormandy and James Schneider will be here to give us their take on that and some of the other bigger news stories of the day. Colombia heads to the polls in less than 2 months, but as our correspondent in Bogota will explain, voters aren't getting excited just yet. We'll also be taking a look at the latest art exhibitions to open in London with Rachel Campbell-Johnston. We'll meet the author of a new novel that imagines a certain historical figure coming back to life, and we'll hear a bit of the most recent Midori House session. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So, a fair few things to fit in the next hour, I'm sure you'll agree. And to kick us all off, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Vladimir Putin has ordered a partial withdrawal of Russian forces deployed along the border with Ukraine. An infantry battalion previously sent to Rostov has been pulled back in a move welcomed by European foreign ministers. It follows the weekend's telephone conversation between the Russian president and Barack Obama on the crisis in Ukraine, and the talks on Sunday between the US Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. Earlier, the Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev became the most high-profile figure so far to travel from Moscow to Crimea, promising to boost the newly annexed territory's economy. Japan says it will honour a court's order to halt its Antarctic whaling program, though it says it's deeply disappointed by the ruling. The International Court of Justice backed a claim by Australia that Japan was conducting commercial whaling while claiming it was primarily for scientific purposes. Since 2005, more than 3,500 minke whales have been killed. Geert Vons, an advisor to the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, says it's vital Japan's operations are closely supervised.
They should fulfill their obligations, they should meet standards, and they have not done so far. The international scientific community has to support, there has to be peer review articles, etc., etc. So this is, I think, a very positive, strong statement.
The charity Médecins Sans Frontières says it is struggling to contain an unprecedented Ebola outbreak in Guinea. 78 people have so far died, and 2 cases have been confirmed in neighbouring Liberia. Officials from the charity say it's proving almost impossible to stop the spread of the disease. The French president is expected to announce a major reshuffle of his government within hours. François Hollande will address the nation in 2 hours' time, a speech in which it's thought he'll confirm Manuel Valls as the new prime minister. It follows disastrous local election results of Mr. Hollande's socialists. They lost more than 150 towns and cities, with the far-right National Front taking control of 11. Australia's prime minister says there's no time limit on the operation to search for the missing Malaysia Airways plane. It's now more than 3 weeks since flight MH370 disappeared. 20 planes and ships are scouring a huge area of the Indian Ocean, where it's thought the plane was lost. After families of some of those on board staged a demonstration over the weekend, the Malaysian Transport Minister Hishamuddin Hussein said he could understand their frustration.
We understand that it has been a difficult time for all the families, and we appreciate that many families want to see physical evidence before they will accept that MH370 ended in the South Indian Ocean. We find ourselves in a difficult position, and I repeat the question that the families principally want answered is the question we simply do not have the answer to.
Lawyers for the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert say they may appeal a court judgment convicting him of corruption. Olmert has been found guilty of bribery over ties to a real estate deal while in his previous post, Mayor of Jerusalem. He could face up to 10 years in prison. Dan Margalit is a commentator on Israeli politics, says the judge reached the right conclusion.
He used the right words, and I believe that Israel will be less corrupt from now on. People will be afraid to do what Mr. Olmert and his friends did in the last 10 years or something like that. Of course, Mr. Olmert does not have any future in our political life.
The South African president, Jacob Zuma, says he should not have to pay for building work on his private home as he didn't ask for it. He's facing corruption charges over work costing $23 million. But Mr. Zuma says government officials ordered that work without his knowledge. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Don't you just hate it when people order work on your property that increases its value hugely without even asking for it? Paul Osborne, thank you very much indeed. It's 18.06 here in London. It's 13.06 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It certainly is Monocle 24, and to be more precise, it is Midori House. Welcome if you're just joining us. I'm joined here in the studio by Xenia Dormandy, US Project Director at the think tank Chatham House here in London, and James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. Xenia and James, thank you both very much for coming. The US Secretary of State, as we were just hearing, John Kerry, met with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov yesterday in Paris to discuss Russia's proposals for a diplomatic solution to the crisis in Ukraine and Crimea. The outcome does not necessarily scream progress. The US will not support the federalisation of Ukraine. It will not support any discussion over Ukraine unless its government is present at the table. And it's asked nicely if Russia could perhaps pull back its troops from Ukraine's eastern borders. Meanwhile, fears of tensions in Crimea are growing as the ethnic Tatars voted over the weekend for self-determination at their national council. Xenia, I guess at least these guys are talking.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can either see this as glass half full or glass half empty. The optimists out there are saying, well, at least the guys are talking. That's the first step. We're using diplomacy. More importantly, the Russians appear to be using diplomacy. There's been no further movement on the 20,000 odd troops sitting on the Russian side of the border with eastern Ukraine. That's all positive. However, there are some who no doubt are thinking right now, is this just a temporary hesitation? Not hesitation isn't even the right word, but kind of a temporary lull by the Russians to lull us into a false sense of security. After which they will then once again claim that the Russians in Ukraine are being hurt in some form or another, and they have to go into eastern Ukraine as well. So I think there are a lot of people who don't trust this in the slightest. And as you pointed out, the federalization of Ukraine is not something that the Ukrainian government, in the American terminology, the legitimate Ukrainian government can accept. And if the Ukrainians can't accept it, the Americans won't.
And James Schneider, the federalization of Ukraine, which, you know, let's be clear about what we're talking about here. That's the fact that Russia wants to break up Ukraine as much as possible. This wasn't something that Russia was necessarily pushing for 2 months ago, 3 months ago, 4 months ago when their guy was in power.
No, they weren't. And the situation's changed, although I'm maybe one of the half full people. I think this was so much better than the last three times that they met, and where they went for a walk in Regent's Park and came back and basically had nothing to say to each other. Kerry gave a bit on talking about minority rights, both religious and linguistic. So there's at least something. But with the who's buying time, I think both sides could be buying time. The US and the West could be buying time to see what strain on the Russian economy sanctions have, and what strain on Putin's inner circle sanction have. And at the same time, Putin's adopting a kind of wait and see, maybe they'll strike later. So it's not, it's better than just being terrible, but there are lots of opportunities for things to go badly wrong afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yes, you're right, it's better than just being terrible. But the question is this actually leading to anything? And what the Russians are putting on the table is something that no sovereign country is ever going to accept. And so, are there any grounds for optimism that actually the Russian intentions and the American intentions overlap? At least as currently being defined, no. On the other hand, if we all take a step back from this for one moment and you look at where we started before the military invasion of Crimea, you actually were in a place where you can see some overlap, which is to say the Europeans were not mandating that Ukraine had to be part of NATO or had to be part of Europe. They were suggesting that Ukraine, if it wanted money from Europe, was going to have to sign up to some trade deals that would have meant that Ukraine could then not sign up to the Russian or the Eurasian trade agreement, I think it's called, led by Russia. So, yes, there is some either this or that. But actually, there is a fair amount in the narrative, a fair amount of space for overlap between what Russia wants, which is a Ukraine on its border that it has some kind of security over, or at least confidence isn't going to be a Western power. But Ukraine hasn't showed any desire to be a truly Western power. So you can, there is an upside, which is you can actually see a solution if they can both pull back sufficiently that is positive for all parties. But it's unclear at the moment whether that's possible.
I don't think that, I mean, I agree with you, there's room for overlap, but I don't think we need to be looking for there to be a kind of perfect confluence of interest between the two sides, because there never is going to be. And the way in which Putin has operated so far is basically to try to strengthen his hand in any negotiations, and that's what is now being done back to him. And there will be some overlap, which kind of creates the narrative and the face saving when something ends up happening. But in the meantime, it's whoever can get on the front foot and whoever can dominate.
But on that issue of whomever can get on the front foot, Russia is quite clearly on the front foot with when you look at the number of troops it has on the border, in a certain sense. But it does Europe in this moment where we're talking about biding for time, do they actually have the time and therefore and indeed the inclination to actually put together proper sanctions, as has been discussed before? This idea that, okay, France will give up the arms deals, Germany will give up some of the gas deals, and London will stop sucking in all the Russian money.
So I think you raise a good point. I mean, I slightly disagree with James. I think that actually right at the moment it's Russia who's moving the goalposts, not the West who is moving the goalposts. The challenge at the moment is, there are many challenges at the moment, but one of the challenges is that Russia appears entirely willing to use military force, which is a very quick action effect, or has a very quick action effect, and the West is using sanctions, economic sanctions, diplomacy, which has a very long period of action. And so at the moment it appears that Russia, at least where Crimea is concerned, is kind of winning the battles, unfortunate terminology, whereas actually the West, there is no question that if the West were willing to impose the kind of sanctions that would really bite on Putin, on the autocrats around him, and even potentially on the country, all of the folk that I speak to who are experts in the economic space say that you could actually make Putin bring him to his knees within a couple of weeks.
Well, now, you say that.
There's a certain amount of skepticism about that, but that's what they tell me.
And a certain amount of skepticism based on the fact that if people look at the history of economic sanctions over the past 40, 50 years. There's a very good analysis of this in the Financial Times today, looking at where it had been tried and where it had worked. And there are very few success stories, aren't there, Zanya?
There are few success stories, but again, each situation is different. So just to take Russia as an example, what I'm told is that the autocrats who support Putin at the top, the business leaders, they're actually quite split. He doesn't have this kind of unitary force around him that are entirely behind him. If you can actually create pain for them that's sufficient, then maybe you can get a different response. What we need to be careful with is when we look at a history of 30 years of sanctions, we're looking at very different types of sanctions. We're looking at sanctions that were imposed on a country, South Africa on the one hand, versus sanctions that are imposed on a series of individuals or institutions. The latter, those targeted sanctions, appear to some degree to be rather more successful than the broad ones.
James Schneider, just on that issue of targeted sanctions, another interesting African example is Zimbabwe, where there have been targeted sanctions on individuals, be that travel bans to Europe or in some cases freezing of assets. Now, some people would say, well, that's all very well, but you know, Robert Mugabe, who's at the centre of these, is still in power.
I think I completely agree with Zeno. It completely depends on the circumstance, and the elite around Robert Mugabe are not really comparable to the elite around Vladimir Putin in terms of how integrated they are into kind of elite European society and assets and so on. So, I mean, whilst we can say, well, Cuba didn't do this or whatever, didn't do that, they are very specific cases, and in some specific cases, sanctions of a sort can work, like in South Africa.
The one thing that has struck me in this whole debate about sanctions is that, you know, a number of people, you know, are saying, as you've just said, Zainia, that actually sanctions could be really effective. But no one has actually confidently said, hand on heart, and I think the West will be able to do this.
And I think that's the real question. I mean, the you know, I've been participating in a lot of conversations over the last few weeks about NATO. And one of the questions, one of the issues there is a lot of people talk about austerity and the fact that the defense budgets are being cut in Europe and in the United States, and therefore does NATO have the capabilities? You talk to the military leaders and they will tell you, absolutely no problem with capabilities, it's will to use those capabilities. And exactly the same question can be asked about sanctions. Sanctions work if they are pervasive, if everybody imposes them on the same individuals, institutions, for the same things, so that actually those individuals, those autocrats can't actually, or those oligarchs can't actually go elsewhere. If it's only being imposed by one country or one institution, they are very unlikely to work because those oligarchs will go elsewhere.
And James
Will
Schneider,
is the issue.
Looking at the issue of Europe, in a sense, there are two stages to this. There's the first stage of, will mainly Britain, France, Germany all agree to take a bit of a hit because it's worth it? Fine. But then there's a second stage, which is, and what happens if Russia hits back and, say, turns off the gas? Who's going to supply energy to, for example, Bulgaria?
Well, obviously, there are severe downsides to sanctions, and there are severe downsides to not doing anything. And it's whether they are willing to meet the kind of very loud talk about the terrible abuse of international law with the possible downside. I mean, of course, if Russia shuts off the gas, it also cripples their economy, and it makes their ability to fight a protracted either cold or a short, you know, real war in eastern Ukraine more difficult. So it's brinkmanship, and it's who will blink first. But I mean, of course, there will be some pain for European countries bringing in sanctions.
And Zane, just finally on this, how much longer do you think until we actually reach an end game here?
This is going to be incredibly drawn out. What is your end game? You know, if you're willing to have Crimea stay as part of Russia over the long term, then, you know, that's your end game. It depends, you know, if Russia decides to invade eastern Ukraine, then everything changes very, very quickly.
We'll leave it there. Zainia Dormady and James Schneider, stay with us. We'll be back with you both in a moment. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau.
Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, joins us now from Tokyo. Can you explain a little bit about this turnaround in price?
The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House.
They're claiming that these are going to be the most compact games of all time.
And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. Plus, don't forget the Daily Monologue, an op-ed piece from one of Monocle's globe-trotting editors. From the sublime to the occasionally ever so slightly ridiculous, find out what the minds inside Midori House are thinking. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Zania Dormady and James Schneider are here with me. In a moment, we'll look at Jacob Zuma and these allegations in South Africa. We'll also, Zania's promising she's going to get out her collection tin. We'll explain about that in a moment. But first, let's talk about panda diplomacy. Xi Jinping is using the gift of two pandas to break the ice with Brussels. His visit to the European headquarters is the first from a Chinese leader since ties were established decades ago. And who better to accompany him than two furry friends? Zania, how seriously do we take the idea of panda diplomacy? Because I know people in Scotland got very excited when two pandas arrived there a couple of years ago. It's been talked about before a lot in terms of, you know, thawing relations between China and Japan. Is it important in any way?
So there's so many things I could say, but I will try and do so with a straight face. The answer is, it would be very easy to mock panda diplomacy in the same way that it would be very easy to mock cricket diplomacy. To give another one, these cultural to cultural links, these people to people links, really do matter. Is it going to change policies? No. You know, Xi Jinping is hoping to open up a huge new trade deal, free trade deal with Europe. That's going to make, in real terms, huge, far greater of an impact between the Chinese and the Europeans. On the other hand, as I say, these cultural links are important. And when people go and visit zoos with pandas in, that gives them a different sense and a different connection that is remarkably important.
It's a different kind of soft, furry power, isn't it, James?
It's a different type of soft furry power, yeah. But as Zania says, that behind it is questions of real power. And I think from looking at it, both sides have, whilst nothing has actually been reached at all, both sides kind of got what they wanted. Because the Europeans really want basically an investor protection agreement for European investors operating in China. And the Chinese said, yeah, we'll keep on negotiating around that. And the Chinese really wanted a commitment that at some stage after that, there'd be discussions for a free trade agreement between the two regions. And the Europeans said, yes, once we have the investor agreement, we'll have that. So there's some nice.
And of course, there were some Belgian school children that said, we want to see something nice at the zoo.
Yes, exactly. Happy school children. And his wife gave a nice talk to some school children as well. So there was some nice fluffy stuff. And then behind it, some serious economic agreements or movements towards economic agreements.
Let's turn to South Africa, where President Jacob Zuma has been defending himself against allegations that, as you just heard in the news headlines, that he unduly profited from state-funded renovation works on his home residence, whose upgrade included a swimming pool, chicken run, and cost $23 million. James Schneider, first of all, how much... We're coming out to an election in South Africa in just a few weeks' time. How important has this story been within the South African press?
It's a really big story, and people have been leading it with it for quite some time, and it's been brewing for over a year. And the kind of responses from the government have looked increasingly stupid until this Thuli Madonsela report came out. And it's doing Jacob Zuma quite a lot of damage because, you know, he either looks corrupt or he looks intensely secretive, saying things like his swimming pool is a security feature and they don't have to give any details about the upgrade because it's a security issue. To now just kind of weirdly incompetent, because his defence has just been, I didn't know what was going on at my own home. I didn't know they were coming to build all of this stuff. It's not my fault. I can't pay it back. I didn't order the builders to come in. But he obviously noticed the builders, because how can you not notice a $23 million upgrade in building a swimming pool?
Well, yes. I think we can just leave that question hanging there. When you look, James, at the sort of the impact that this might have on the election, you know, in any other country, If the president was at the centre of a scandal like this, you'd think, well, you know, does it do his re-election chances any harm? In South Africa, where, you know, the ANC has never got less than 60% of the vote, it shouldn't really affect things too much, should it?
No, but it could affect whether Zuma serves out a full second term, because, I mean, he's already in his early 70s. He's pretty tainted. He's less popular than the party. There was a poll a couple months ago that had 50% of the population wanted him to go right now. And I think it could strengthen the hand of those within the party who think, OK, give it 2 or 3 years and then he can retire on age grounds and they can get someone in who
doesn't
put
his foot
in
it so much.
And he's got a really nice place to retire to. Maybe that's the deal. You know, we'll give you this, tarnish you a bit, and then you can go and retire in your nice compound.
Zeni Dawoodi, when we look at South Africa diplomatically, you know, they have sort of somehow forced themselves into the BRICS group, by hook or by crook. They want a permanent seat on the Security Council. They want to be seen as sort of the voice for Africa. And yet, when things like, for example, Crimea happens, no one is saying, ooh, I wonder what South Africa thinks of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually quite interesting. If you look at it diplomatically, kind of from the global scale, you know, a decade ago, everybody was talking about South Africa and South African growth and South Africa kind of becoming, stepping up to the front stage. And now people are saying that about Nigeria. And they're no longer talking about South Africa. And I suspect even Nigeria is beginning to wax a little bit, or wane a little bit, I should say. And it's being replaced by, you know, by the next great African star. And so there's something here about kind of leadership, perhaps. And I think that Zuma is seeing those struggles right now about, you know, whether countries like this, again, you look at the other BRICS, you look at Brazil, you look at India, all growth figures coming down for all of these countries. Russia, we were talking about that earlier. You know, there's a real problem here with making these kind of predictions about future leadership, global stance, that don't necessarily hold out over long periods unless they've got the leadership to sustain that.
And oddly as well, all the BRICS, except of course, you know, the R in BRIC, have abstained on votes to do with the situation in Russia. They've all taken a sort of, they haven't rushed to Russia's defence. They've all stood at the sidelines going, oh, we'd rather not talk about this.
They're all in quite a comfortable, I mean, you know, we were talking actually, James and I were talking about India earlier. China, too, is actually in a really uncomfortable situation because they've all got some kind of sovereignty issues themselves. And so on the one hand, they're very anti what Russia's just done. But on the other hand, you know, here's their ally in the BRICS and they don't want to be seen to be pushing too hard.
We're going to talk just before we go about fundraising. There was a very nice piece in the New York Times over the weekend highlighting the supposed joys of fundraising. Zainin, you've raised a bit of money in your time for
that sounds kind of interesting. Yes, I have raised a bit of money in my time for Chatham House.
But part of what you have to do is raise money, and James, you have to do the same for Think Africa Press. Do you see it as a chore, or is there actually a side to it which is actually helps to reaffirm? Because you have to make the case for what it is
exactly.
You're doing.
So I actually really like the article, Why Fundraising is Fun, although I don't necessarily agree with him about why it's fun. I would say two things about it. I mean, one, and this is true whether you're fundraising or anything else, you actually you're forced to talk to people you wouldn't otherwise talk to. I mean, it's why Monocle is so great. You know, you actually have conversations that aren't part of your normal kind of agenda, and actually getting out of your comfort box is actually a really good thing. The other part of it is actually connecting people or institutions to achieve more efficiency, to achieve gains, to achieve positive outcomes. Actually, that really is fun, and that's kind of what he's talking about. So again, it's all about Monocle.
Good. James, are you as enthusiastic about fundraising?
Maybe not quite as enthusiastic, but I do really like the focus of the article, which basically says rather than egoism being the kind of driving force for what we're trying to do, is perhaps altruism is. And perhaps what we're really kind of struggling over is the means and the ability to be altruistic and to be able to do things for other people. And that's where fulfillment lies, which is kind of the reverse of everything that we've been told in the kind of development of social science in the last 30 or 40 years with rational choice theory. So I like the idea.
Okay, excellent. James Schneider and Xenia Dormady, they'll be collecting outside later. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, dette Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Lots still to look forward to in the final half hour of Midori House, don't you worry. Author Timo Vermes will join us to talk about his book, Look Who's Back. I won't tell you who is back. Anastasia Maloney will be with us from Bogota and will also be reviewing some of the week's art in London. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the headlines.
Russia has cut the number of soldiers deployed along the country's border with Ukraine. An infantry battalion's been withdrawn, a move that's been welcomed by European foreign ministers. It comes after the weekend's meeting between the US Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. Earlier, the Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev visited Crimea, the most high-profile figure from Moscow to go since it was annexed. Guinea is facing an unprecedented outbreak of Ebola, according to the charity Médecins Sans Frontières. 78 people are now known to have died, and cases have been confirmed in neighbouring Liberia. The French President François Hollande is due to address the nation in an hour and a half's time after disastrous local election results for his Socialist Party. It lost control of more than 150 towns and cities. 11 were won by the far-right National Front. It's thought Mr. Hollande will announce a government reshuffle, including the appointment of the current Interior Minister Manuel Valls as Prime Minister. Japan has been ordered to temporarily halt its Antarctic whaling programme. The UN's International Court of Justice sided with Australia, which maintains the programme is not for scientific research, but is commercial whaling in disguise. And a major report on climate change says it's likely to have a severe, pervasive and irreversible impact. The second report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is thought to be the most comprehensive assessment yet of the impact of global warming. It says that high risk of flooding and food shortages could prompt a series of crises. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. Time for us now to cross to Bogota, where our correspondent Anastasia Maloney is waiting there for us, primed to tell us what's going on in Bogota. Anastasia, welcome to Midori House.
Hi, good afternoon.
Let us begin with the election campaign that's, I'd like to say, is heating up, but you think it's been rather boring, don't you?
Yeah, I do, and so does the local media. There's a recent editorial in one of the main leading newspapers, El Tiempo, that said that, you know, the presidential candidates really need to start captivating voters and resonate more with voters because they're calling it a boring campaign that hasn't got off the ground yet. And people are saying that they really want to hear about what the presidential candidates are doing to improve three key issues that are among voters' minds, which is health service, education and crime. And the current president, Juan Manuel Santos, he's up for re-election, but he hasn't really touched on those issues. He's still focusing on the peace process with the FARC rebels in Havana, and that's not really getting voters excited at the moment.
It's interesting, Anastasia, because I mean, I remember when I was last in Colombia and we were talking about the upcoming election, and everyone was saying, well, look, you know, the peace process is going to be the big thing, and the issue will be whether we stick with the peace process or whether we let it go. And yet, actually, you seem to be saying now that the big issues that people are worried about have nothing to do with the peace process at all. Why do you think that's changed?
I think, basically, it's very difficult for Colombians to believe in a peace process when many people say so little progress has been made so far. They can't really relate to what's happening in Havana to their real lives and their own lives back in Colombia. And this is not the first time that Colombians have been through a peace process. This is the third failed attempt. So people are generally apathetic and almost indifferent about what's going on in Cuba. And what people are more worried about is sending their kids to a good school and making sure that when they get to hospitals, they'll get a decent service. Those seem to be, at the moment, according to local polls, what people are actually really worried about. People say the peace process happens, that's great, but they can't see the moment, the connection between a peace deal and how that's really going to improve their lives. And I think that's the problem that Santos, the president, is facing and has to sort of whip up support and momentum and get people on board this peace process.
Let's look now at another politician who's trying to be a bit more hands-on, perhaps, and that's Rafael Pardo, who's the new mayor-elect in Bogotá. He took the position after Gustavo Petro was sacked, and the big issue that he's dealing with is traffic and the lack of public transport. How is he getting on so far, Anastasia?
Well, he's been basically circling above Bogota on a helicopter for a couple of days during his first week, which people thought, well, at least he's trying to tackle the traffic and see where the real bottlenecks are. He's proposed to look at several solutions to stem traffic in the city, and one of those is to extend the car license plate restrictions. At the moment, if you own a car in Bogota, you can't use it on certain times, 2 days a week, and he's looking to extend that so that there's less cars on the street, perhaps even include tolls in the city and congestion charges like you get in London. But people are saying that's not the real problem. The real problem is the lack of public transport. There's no subway system in Bogota, and the public buses, there simply aren't enough, and people are complaining they have to wait hours to even get on a bus to go to work. So for many Bogotanos, this is a critical issue because they spend simply too long getting to work and back home. And I think Rafael Pardo has understood that, and so he's decided to make this a priority, the first thing that he's going to tackle. Many mayors have tried to do it, and many mayors have failed, so we'll have to see whether he's got any new initiatives that can really decrease the number of cars on the streets in Bogota.
Well, as you say, yeah, many mayors of Bogota have tried before. Enrique Peñalosa was one who's now, you know, running for president against Juan Manuel Santos. What is it that makes people think that maybe Rafael Pardo is the man who can actually finally turn this around?
Well, actually, I mean, he's only seen as an interim mayor. Most people don't really expect him to do much. He's going to only be in the post for a couple of months. He's seen as a presidential appointment, which he is. He's seen as, some people, skeptics are saying, it's only really the President Santos is using Bogota as sort of a campaign platform. People are upset about that. They don't expect Pardo to do much. They just expect him to keep the peace, be seen to be doing something at least. And then Bogota will go to another election to decide another mayor, and that candidate list is still being decided on. So Rafael Pardo is sort of a bit like a sitting duck at the moment. He's trying to do something, but Bogotanos aren't really expecting to do much.
Anastasia, let's turn to the issue of culture. On Friday, the Ibero-American Theatre of Bogota kicks off in the city. Tell us a bit about this event, because it only happens every couple of years, doesn't it?
That's right. It happens every 2 years, and it's billed as one of the biggest theatre festivals in the world. Hundreds of theatre groups and dance groups from across the world come to Bogota, and it's basically 2 weeks where every single theatre in Bogota is packed. It's got at least three different programs a day. There's street theatre, there's dance groups, there's puppet shows, and it's really seen as, if you like theatre, you can't miss this event. And it's a chance for Bogotanos to see plays in different languages from Kosovo, Serbia, all of Europe. African dance groups come, and you don't really get a lively theatre scene in Bogota, but during these 2 weeks, it's a great chance to every night go to the theatre or see a production.
Anastasia Maloney, I'm sure you'll be filling us in on some of the highlights of the Ibero-American Theatre of Bogota later on in the next few days. But for now, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House.
If you thought Vancouver fashion was just about open-toed sandals and fleeces, think again. Local clothing brands are on the rise, giving the city a stylish boost. Monocle Films headed to the West Coast to meet forward-thinking retailers.
When we first opened this location in Chinatown in 2011, and it was really new at that time. There wasn't too much really going on in the neighborhood. We're pretty much one of the only ones on the block. But since then, it has grown quite a bit. It's become a really great little, kind of like if you know, then you know kind of places.
Fashion City, Vancouver. Now playing in the film section on Monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still to come, a very special Midori House session from the Pierces. And we'll also be reviewing the latest art from London. But first, they say time is the greatest healer of all. But what would they say of comedy? Germany is perhaps the last in line to realise any comic potential in reviving Adolf Hitler in fiction. But that's changing. 2 years ago, the German author Timo Vermes did just that. In his book, Look Who's Back, he envisages a Hitler awoken in the 21st century with no memory of time past since 1945. And it turns out he's a bit of a comic too. Look Who's Back has now been translated into English after a hugely successful run in Germany. I'm delighted to say that Timo Vermes joins me in the studio. Timo, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Now, first of all, talk me through the cover. Because this is the same cover as you've had in for the German edition, although obviously the language is slightly different. A sort of a Hitler haircut and the actual title as his moustache. Was this your idea or the idea of a wonderful designer?
No. Actually, I had another idea. My idea was take the Hitler from a former poster and give him some modern bits so you can recognize he has a time traveling behind him. But as soon as I saw this draft, it was clear to everyone that's the better opinion, and that the it's translated in some languages already, and nearly everyone has chosen this cover, so it's a good sign.
It certainly leaps out at you. Now, before we talk about the story itself, why did you think that it was, you know, that this was sort of good territory for you as a writer? Because it's funny. I mean, anyone who travels through Germany and looks on the newsstands will see, you know, yeah, every time you go through a German airport, there'll be, you know, Hitler will be on the front cover of so many different news magazines and newspapers.
I didn't pick it because it was a good subject for me, but I liked it because it was entertaining to me, or seemed to me entertaining to me, because if you're starting writing a novel, there's no guarantee that you will sell it. So if you start writing it, and if you're a lazy writer like me, then you think, okay, if it doesn't pay, then it should be fun. And that was in the beginning the first impulse and the first motivation, that I wanted to have fun myself. And from that one, it helped me finishing the book. But if it would have become boring, I would have stopped writing.
And the story, as we say, sort of envisages Adolf Hitler, you know, waking up in the 21st century in 2011, not knowing what's happened and not really recognizing, obviously, the country around him that Germany has become. What does that say, and what does the Germany that Hitler finds say about the changes in the country over the last 60 years?
Well, what he is noticing is, if I understood the question right, well, what he's noticing is that just obviously there has something changed, but under that he sees that the same old processes are still working, and there's not so much of a difference to back then. People are behaving like people are behaving. They are not changing that much, and he can use them, and more of that, they help them on their own interest.
Did you find it difficult writing this book, and certainly trying to sell this book in a country where, obviously, you know, Hitler isn't really a figure of fun?
I didn't find it that difficult, because I had some professional experience, so I knew that you need to offer a book, especially a book like this, you need an agent. And if you have an agent, and this agent is telling you, okay, it's strange, but keep on writing. And if you finish the book, then I will offer it to someone. Then you have a perspective and you're on a quite, you feel on a quite right way. And after all, we had the finished manuscript and we offered it to 11 publishers and 10 of them wanted to have it. So
it suggests you're doing something right.
Yeah, of course. And it was, this book always needs someone to help you starting with it. When I first showed it to my agent, I didn't tell her what it was about. I said, just take it, read it. Do you want to have more? And it was the same thing she did with the publisher companies. We have something special here, and I don't tell you what it's all about, because, of course, if in the beginning you say, I have a funny book about Hitler or with Hitler, it's like a funny book with cancer. Not so easy to believe. So she said, I don't tell you what it's all about. Take it for the weekend at home and say to me, tell me on Monday, what do you think of it? And that's someone helping it. She is a professional agent showing to the publishing company that this is a serious offer. And that's the next step.
Now, this book's also been translated into several languages.
Yeah.
Several countries around the world have published it. Have you noticed a difference in the way it's received in other countries compared to Germany?
Surprisingly, not that much. I always thought that it would be very important for the book to have this German bad conscience. And it seems to be working without in the other countries. It gets different, or people seem to me more interested if they have some experience with dictators or with some dictatorship form of government, which means in Hungary, very, very open-minded, very, very interested in this. Also in Spain, where they had Franco, also in Portugal, where I didn't remember all those dictators anymore, where they had Salazar, and where they thought, well, we couldn't do this with our dictator, but interesting, they did this with their Hitler. So it helps, maybe.
And did you ever find it difficult when writing it, thinking, well, I'm not sure how sympathetic I want to make this character of mine? Because you want it to be a nuanced characterization. You don't want it all to be in black and white. But is there a difficulty in making him in any way likable?
I had a different way of getting to this matter. I didn't want to cheat. I wanted to understand him, why he did what he did. And then I thought at some moments, how blunt can I get? Or how blunt am I allowed to be? And I found this form, which would be the most probable one, that he is telling about what he's intending to do or what he did. And he's making no excuses, but he's not talking about it all of the time. I thought it's more like some bank robber who is not telling to you. He and his friends, they are not talking about the crimes all the time. They are talking about how they want to spend the money. But the crime, it's evident. They all were there. There's nothing to talk about. And that's what I found out about Hitler, reading his speeches and reading his monologues in the headquarters. He's not talking about the Holocaust all of the time. It's clear to everyone, this is necessary. We will do that. We don't have to discuss it anymore. It's already done and we are already taking those steps. And yeah, let's talk about something else. Let's talk about how it's the best way to drive a car and drive carefully if there are children around. And yeah.
Timo Vermes, thank you very much indeed for coming in. The book is called Look Who's Back. You will be able to spot it a mile off in any bookshop. Timo, thank you very much indeed. Some music now. You can hear more from these guys on The Culture Show later with Rob. They came in the other day. It's The Pierces with Kings.
What strikes fear in the heart of one man might not even move another. While a stranger gets your hand, you turn your back upon your brother. And you know, you know, you know, you know, we all want the highest towers and the valleys at our feet. We are counting down the hours till a life of love will meet. And you know, you know, you know, you know, you know. it's gonna take some time. If we want to, we could do what kings do. I could feel the earth move when you speak. If we fight through all the things we once knew, everything could change for me and you. We could do what kings do.
That was Kings by The Pierces, and I said you can hear more from them on Culture with Rob. Listen out in particular for their rather wonderful version of Ordinary World. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time for us to, before we end the show, have a little review of the latest art exhibitions opening here in London. I'm joined now by Rachel Campbell-Johnson, art critic for The Times of London. Rachel, thank you very much for joining us today. We're going to start with the British Museum and a new exhibition, Sutton Hoo and Europe, AD 300 to 1100. Tell me, why should I be excited about this?
Well, this is not actually a show. It's a new gallery that's opened. And basically, it brings the whole world of Beowulf back to life. It's an early medieval art gallery. And what it conjures really freshly is a vision of a really fierce, fantastical, and yet actually really surprisingly sophisticated era, which we're so familiar with from, I suppose, the pages of our oldest vernacular epic. At the heart of it is the finds of Sutton Hoo. It was a ship that was buried, and it was thought to have belonged to or be the burial ground of a king. And there's the very, very famous Sutton Hoo helmet that is probably familiar to most people who've been to the British Museum. It's an extraordinary piece. I mean, they put together all these corroded fragments, reconstructed it, and it is as if Sir Beowulf himself is looking out at us, gripping our gaze from across the millennium and a half of history.
It's a quite frightening looking helmet, isn't it, in a sense? It's sort of, you do feel like there's something in there.
Well, it's a sort of trompe l'oeil, really, because you see at first this rather savage metallic face, and then you look again, and it's turned into a flying dragon. I mean, the wings are the eyebrows, the fanning tail doubles up as a moustache, and the frown central furrow is this viciously toothed head which rises up to meet a dragon that curves over in a very elaborate helmet crest. And it's all shining and glittering. It's studded with garnets and it's polished gold. And this is, you know, in Beowulf, they talk about the shining helmet which he puts on before he has to do battle with Grendel's mother. And this brings that era to life. It's just one of masses of pieces that they bring together. And what they're trying to stress is the interconnectedness, that Britain wasn't set apart, that Scandinavian, Roman, Frankish, Byzantine pieces all were interconnected as people began to move across the continent in this 800 years of history. I mean, here we're going from the late antiquity and the collapse of the Roman Empire to the end of the early medieval period. And it's telling a continuous cultural story, really, using some of the finest treasures that the British Museum has.
And it's also there's also an interesting story to tell about how the Sutton Hoo was found in the first place, because it's the 75th anniversary of the discovery.
Yeah, I mean, it was someone found a few of these old pieces and they gradually began to dig it up, and they found all these different mounds with the most astonishing treasures in that they, as I say, they began to think they must have come from a king or at least a very, very high nobleman. And I think it's probably the greatest collection of objects of that sort ever unearthed, let alone in Britain.
Let's cross now to the National Gallery, which has a rather wonderful new exhibition all about Renaissance Venice.
Yeah, this is Veronese, Magnificence and Renaissance Venice. And I have to say, if there's only one exhibition that you're really going to make an effort to travel to see this year, I would make sure that it's this one. I mean, this is the most...
As in the only one this year, you'd say it's that good?
I would say this year. This was a revelation to me. I mean, I've always been taught that he was... I remember sort of art historically learning. He was a decorative master. He's part of that great Renaissance triumvirate of Venetian masters. Titian was much older, Tintoretto was a little older, and then Veronese. And he was always seen as someone who made frescoes, decorating great palaces and churches, and his decorative skills are incredibly sophisticated. But what makes this show really special is that of the 500 or 600 words attributed to him, because he had a very busy workshop, they've chosen only those that are considered to be by his hand alone, and he is a superlative painter. I mean, it was said that he never put his brush in the wrong place and that his figures were always finished at the second stroke. And as you look at these canvases, you almost feel that alchemical magic of the moment of making, coming alive afresh. I mean, the basic aim of this show is not to teach you anything particularly new. It offers you a clear overview of his career. But by the time that you leave him sort of 50 canvases later, you're standing before works in which every detail becomes part of the dramatic story. And he's looked so carefully at the narratives, admittedly sometimes quite complicated narratives. You have to know your mythology and your biblical stories well. But with such concentrated intensity and really subtle theatrical power, people who may have tended to describe him as a mere decorator, I think, will be really tempted to reconsider.
And it's interesting you say that they're only showing those works that they're absolutely sure were his and his alone. How difficult is it with an artist like Veronese to really be that sure when he's worked with so many others?
Well, the thing about Veronese is he has this extraordinary brush, which you see moving across the surface. It twiddles, it turns, it flicks light, and it's so quick and fast. And the grander, bigger schemes, and actually a lot of them obviously can't travel because they are frescoes. They're set in plaster in the churches for which they're made. They've got a more laboured feel, they're a more careful feel of apprentices. And of course, Veronese would have worked on features of them and on parts of them, like any of the great masters of a workshop would have done. But these works, mostly on canvas, although there are one or two frescoes. And actually, what I have to say is some works are on travelling for the very, very first time. There's a massive martyrdom of St. George, and it's been taken from its altar in Verona for the only time of its history. Actually, once out of the time, Napoleon carried it away, apparently. He was rather covetous of it.
Rachel, just finally, and very, very quickly, because we're running out of time, the Tate Britain has a new installation at the Duveen Gallery by Phila de Barlo. Tell us quickly about this.
Yeah, well, this is a most ambitious installation of Phila de Barlo, very formative artist in that she's taught so many of our young British artists now. It looks like a great flood swept in from the Thames and right through the grand spaces. Pieces of driftwood all piled up in higgledy-biggledy towers, huge black cases dangling, smashed open, untidy heaps of canvases. It looks like the debris of a flood. And the basic idea of Phila de Barlo is, quite apart from making something eye-stretching, that you literally have to make your way through, you know, it's a sort of labyrinth you have to go through, is to undermine the sort of monumental sculptures that we think of, the perfectly made pieces that harmonise with the rhythms of the gallery, and show that sculpture is something precarious, transitory, about to topple. And so she makes this willfully anti-monumental confection of junk, which is literally eye-stretching.
There we are. Rachel Campbell-Johnson, thank you very much indeed. That ends today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Xenia Dormandy and James Schneider. Midori House was produced by Alad John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Janie Cho. The studio manager was Alex Funnell. Culture with Rob is next. After the headlines, you can hear the Pierces and also an interview with Anish Kapoor. Midori is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.